Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We spend a lot of time on this show talking about things you can, you know, see. Stock markets, political shifts,
Right.
new tech.
Tangible stuff.
Exactly. But
Yeah.
today, we are going deep. I mean, literally deep into this invisible world right under our feet.
The world of our infrastructure.
We're exploring the really intense, complex, and vital world of sewer line chemical root control. And look, this isn't just about calling a plumber for a simple blockage in your house.
No, not at all.
This is about understanding and managing really a full-scale subterranean war against what is arguably the single most destructive pest in any wastewater collection system,
Tree roots.
tree roots.
That's exactly right. And, you know, because the standards for this kind of work are so incredibly high, we're talking about restricted use pesticides, sensitive public infrastructure.
Right.
We really wanted to frame this deep dive as an essential audio study guide. This material was generated by Within Range Coaching. They're an agribusiness consulting firm, and their whole mission is helping small agribusinesses stay safe and, more importantly, compliant in this really specialized field.
That makes sense because our sources for this are dense. I mean, they are laser focused on regulatory compliance, the actual pesticide science, and the very precise procedures for using chemicals like, what is it, metam sodium.
Metam sodium and diclobenol, yeah.
So our mission here is to get beyond just reading the rules out of a manual. We want to distill this into something comprehensive, actionable, and I think, above all, safe knowledge.
Exactly. We're turning that dense legal and chemical text into professional, essential expertise for the people actually out there on the front lines.
Because the stakes here, I mean, they're just too high for anything less than absolute precision.
Absolute precision and compliance. That's what we're aiming to deliver.
So let's set the stage. When you and I think of pests, we're probably picturing, I don't know, cockroaches or mites.
Sure. Insects, rodents.
Why are tree roots the undisputed champions of destruction when it comes to wastewater infrastructure?
They are, and it's almost not even a competition. They're universally considered the single most destructive problem.
Wow.
I mean, you can have issues with shifting soil or, you know, other things, but the persistence and the sheer growth potential of roots is just unmatched.
And the immediate problem is what we all see, right? The emergency call.
That's it. The sewer stoppages and overflows, that's usually the first sign for the public and for the operators that something is wrong.
But those stoppages, they're really just the symptom of a much deeper, and I have to assume, much more expensive problem, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. The long-term issues are the catastrophic ones. We're talking about severe structural damage.
How does that happen?
Well, roots are programmed to seek out moisture. So when they find a pike joint, and we could be talking about a microscopic opening, they invade.
Just a tiny crack.
A tiny crack. And once they're inside, they just grow. They get bigger in diameter, longer, and they exert this immense constant pressure.
Like a wedge.
Exactly like a wedge. It cracks pipes, it can shear connections right off, and it spreads the joints apart. And that structural failure, that's the real financial drain.
And when those joints spread, that's when you start hearing about things like I&I, right? Infiltration and inflow.
Precisely. That structural damage lets clean groundwater, that's the infiltration and storm runoff, the inflow, pour into the sewer system.
Just overloads everything.
Dramatically, it overloads the pipes, it overloads the treatment plants, but it gets worse.
Hell.
If you have a severe root mass that creates even a partial blockage, water starts to pool up behind it. It creates what are called septic pools.
Okay, stagnant water.
Stagnant septic water. And that environment generates huge amounts of hydrogen sulfide gas, H2S.
The rotten egg smell.
That's the one. But it's not just an odor problem. That gas combines with the water vapor inside the pipe and it forms sulfuric acid.
So it's literally creating acid inside the pipe.
And that acid chemically dissolves the concrete and the mortar. It just eats the pipe away from the inside out, which accelerates that whole structural damage cycle.
So the root causes a physical block, which then triggers a chemical reaction that destroys the pipe itself.
It's a beautifully destructive feedback loop. It really is. And even if the pipe holds together, that root mass can reduce the hydraulic capacity so much that the pipe can't clean itself anymore. The flow isn't fast enough to carry solids away.
But the structural damage is still the big ticket item.
It's always the most costly because that usually means you're digging up streets to replace or reline the entire pipe.
The tenacity of these things is just, it's amazing. I was floored by that data point in the source. about roots being found 2,500 feet from the nearest tree.
In the Moffett Tunnel in Colorado, yeah.
That's almost half a mile away.
And that example just perfectly illustrates their biological drive. I mean, roots are unbelievably tenacious. Some grass roots can live for thousands of years.
And what's the force that drives them that far?
It's a process called hydrotropism. It's the active directional growth of the root toward moisture. They can literally sense a moisture gradient in the soil, and they will pursue it relentlessly.
And our urban environment, we're basically just making it worse for ourselves.
We are. We're turbocharging this whole process. We pave over their normal water sources with asphalt and concrete. We rake up all the leaves so there are no nutrients on the surface. Our storm drains whisk all the surface water away.
So we're forcing them to dig deeper.
We are environmentally forcing them deeper and farther out to find anything to eat or drink.
Which makes a sewer pipe. It's like an oasis in the desert.
It's the perfect analogy. It's a hydroponic heaven for them.
Why is it so perfect?
Because it provides four critical things all at once. You've got warmth from the sewage. You've got constant moisture. Even just condensation on the outside of the pipe is enough to attract them.
And inside.
Inside, you have nutrient-rich water seeping from any tiny crack, and this is the crucial part, a well-ventilated, oxygen-rich atmosphere inside the pipe, above the waterline.
Ah, so they need to breathe.
Most roots can't survive if they're constantly submerged. They thrive in that headspace.
So even in a pipe that's flowing pretty full, that little air gap at the top is where the real damage is happening.
That's exactly where they colonize. They find an entry point, even if it's just a few cells wide. They get in, and then they just explode in that perfect environment.
And that leads to the actual structures that applicators find inside the pipes. The sources identified two main types, right? A veil type and a tail type.
Correct. And the type of root mass tells you a lot about the flow inside that pipe. The veil type is what you see in pipes with constant, steady flow. Big interceptor pipes, usually.
What does it look like?
The roots grow in from the top or the sides, and they hang down like curtains, just barely touching the surface of the water.
Like a net?
Exactly. Yeah. A biological rake. It catches everything that flows by, solids, grease, debris, until that curtain gets so thick it causes a total blockage. And a key thing for applicators is that the live roots are almost never below the water level. They're up in that oxygenated space. Okay, and the tail type sounds more aggressive?
Oh, they're much more dramatic. They look like a horse's tail, and you find them in pipes with low or intermittent flow. Think smaller collector sewers or the laterals coming from a house.
And they can grow from anywhere.
Top, bottom, sides, it doesn't matter. And they grow aggressively downstream. The sources mention that these things can form solid tubes of root material over 20 feet long.
20 feet.
A solid mass. The only sign that there was ever flow is a little flat spot on the bottom where the sewage ran.
And knowing the difference veil versus tail, that's got to be critical for the chemical application.
It's everything. It tells you where that foam needs to go to make maximum contact with the active growth zone.
Okay, so moving from the biology of the problem to the chemistry of the solution.
Right.
This is where we shift into the world of regulation.
A hard shift.
The moment you introduce a chemical to kill a plant in a public utility, this stops being a plumbing issue.
And it becomes a regulated pesticide application issue. You're now working under federal and state pesticide laws, period.
And the definition of a pesticide is actually really broad, isn't it?
It is. It's any substance that's intended for preventing, destroying, repelling, or mitigating any pest. And yes, roots in a sewer system are absolutely legally defined as a pest.
There's a really critical distinction here I want to highlight, especially for professionals listening. It's about product claims.
Yes, this is huge for compliance. Even if a company markets a product as, say, a degreaser, if anywhere on the label or the website or in a brochure, they make the claim that it also kills or controls roots.
It's a pesticide.
Instantly. It's regulated as a pesticide under federal law. And that brings it under the full authority of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act.
FIFRA.
FIFRA. That's the foundation for everything we're about to talk about.
So what are the absolute non-negotiable requirements that FIFRA puts on using something like metamsodium?
First, FIFRA classifies all products as either general use or restricted use. Metamsodium products are restricted use pesticides, or RUPs.
And that classification triggers the main requirement.
It does. The defining rule is that anyone who handles or supervises the use of a restricted use pesticide must be certified as competent.
By who?
By the EPA or by a state agency that's operating under EPA guidelines. Certification isn't a suggestion. It is a federal mandate. It's proof that you have the knowledge to use that material safely.
And we should clarify the types of certification, because this study guide is really for commercial operations.
Right. The law makes a distinction. You have private applicators who might be farmers using RUPs on their own property to grow a crop.
Okay.
And then you have commercial applicators. That's anyone using an RUP for any other purpose. So municipal workers, contractors doing sewer line root control, they're all commercial applicators.
And the requirements are tougher for them.
Typically, yes. More extensive testing, continuing education credits, because the application sites, public spaces, urban environments carry a much higher public risk.
And the penalties for messing this up, they are not small.
They are severe, and they're designed to be a deterrent. A commercial applicator can face civil penalties up to $5,000 for each offense.
Each one.
But it's the criminal penalties that really get your attention. If an applicator knowingly violates a part of FIFRA, they can be fined up to $50,000.
Wow.
And or sentenced to 1 year in prison.
So when we talk about compliance, this isn't about, you know, just jumping through some minor regulatory hoops.
No. This is about protecting your business, your personal freedom, and public health. It's serious.
So what puts a chemical like metamsodium in that restricted use category in the first place?
It's all about inherent hazard. RUPs are in that category because they have a higher potential to harm humans, animals, or the environment compared to general use products.
So they need special training.
Special knowledge, special training to make sure they're used correctly and safely. The label on an RUP will state very clearly that it can only be purchased and applied by or under the direct supervision of a certified applicator. It ensures accountability all the way through the chain.
Now, here's where the regulatory web gets kind of surprising. I would not naturally connect the Endangered Species Act with a manhole on a city street.
It's a niche, but it is a critical compliance check. Before you treat a site, you have to consult with state and federal wildlife offices to make sure there are no endangered species on or right next to that site.
Why? I mean, it's a sewer pipe.
Because they are not always sterile concrete tunnels. That example from the source is about the gray myotis bat in Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Right.
It's a perfect illustration. These bats are federally protected, and they use the stable, dark environment of city sewers and drainage tunnels as places to hibernate or raise their young.
So before you go pumping a toxic fumigant into a pipe, you have a legal duty to make sure you're not gassing a protected species.
You have a positive legal obligation to verify that. It's another layer of due diligence that shows environmental compliance is way more than just protecting the water treatment plant.
And beyond wildlife, there are the obligations to the human workers, which fall under OSHA. The Hazard Communication Standards.
HCS.
Can you just break that down for us? What are the employer's core responsibilities here?
Absolutely. HCS basically says that every employee has a right to know about the hazardous chemicals they work with and how to protect themselves. For a firm like Within Range Coaching, this is a huge point of emphasis. It boils down to four main things for the employer.
Okay.
One, you have to keep an accurate list of all hazardous chemicals on site. Two, you need a safety data sheet, an SDS, for every single one of those chemicals. And it has to be easily accessible to the workers.
Not locked in an office somewhere.
Exactly, not locked away. Three, all your containers have to be properly labeled with the contents and the hazard warnings. And four, you have to provide and document very specific training on the hazards, the PPE, and the emergency procedures.
And that SDS, along with product label, that's basically the applicator's Bible, right?
They are the legal foundation of the job. For an RUP, the label is a legal document. It tells you everything. The exact PPE, the mixing rates, where you can apply it, the environmental hazards. If you read that label and you do something different,
you're breaking federal law.
You're breaking federal law. It's that simple.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, the strategies.
We know the threat is relentless, but the toolbox for fighting it is pretty diverse. Let's start with the best non-chemical options, the long-term stuff.
The absolute best strategy is always preventative. Good planning, proper installation.
Meaning
when you put in new pipes, you use airtight gasketed joints and you inspect them thoroughly, especially where the laterals from buildings connect to the main. Those are major weak spots.
And what about planning above ground?
Wise landscape choices. This is huge.
So what's a bad choice? Give me an example of a tree that's just a nightmare for sewer lines.
Willows, silver maples, cottonwoods, they are notoriously invasive, they grow fast, and they are incredibly thirsty. You have to educate homeowners not to plant these adventure-seeking trees anywhere near utility lines.
Okay, so planning fails, the roots are in, and now they're causing serious structural damage. That's when we move to physical control.
Right. Things like tree removal, pipe replacement, or relining.
Tree removal seems drastic, and maybe not even a quick fix.
It's very expensive, and you're right, it often doesn't solve the problem immediately. The roots can survive for years after the tree is gone, so you still have to monitor and maybe even treat them chemically.
And pipe replacement is just chaos.
It's hugely disruptive and incredibly costly. Digging up streets is always the last resort.
Which is why pipe relining is so popular. Mm. No digging. But it's not a silver bullet, is it?
Relining the main line is very effective. You install the seamless liner inside the old pipe, and it stops roots from getting through cracks in that section.
Mm.
But the major disadvantage is that the liner usually stops at the main. It doesn't extend up into those older, often clay tile, unlined laterals coming from the houses.
Ah, so the roots can just find another way in.
They can re-enter the system right through those unprotected connections. So relining often has to be paired with chemical treatment of the laterals to be a complete solution.
All right, let's get to the most common thing people see. Mechanical cleaning.
Mm.
The jetters, the rotters, they clear the blockage.
They do. They provide immediate relief, and you have to use them in an emergency. If a pipe is 100% blocked, you have to clear it mechanically before you can do anything else.
But there's a biological consequence.
Yes. This is so important to understand. Mechanical cleaning is a short-term fix only. And worse, it actively encourages the problem to get worse over the long term. This is what we call the biological backlash.
Explain that process. How does cutting a root make it come back stronger?
Okay, so when you injure a root, when you slice it with a mechanical blade, the plant produces a stress hormone. It's called epsithic acid.
Okay.
Now, you'd think that would signal the root to die back, but it does the opposite. It triggers a survival response that actually hastens and thickens the regrowth right at the site of the injury.
So the plant's basically fighting back.
It's saying, my water source is under attack, I have to secure it, and I'm gonna grow back stronger and faster to do it.
So every time you send a cutting tool down that pipe, you're not just getting a temporary fix, you're actively training that root mass to come back heavier and denser.
Precisely. You are putting the pipe under more and more stress over time. And that is why chemical treatment is necessary for long-term management. It kills the root and suppresses that regrowth.
So what are the chemical options on the table?
We can break them down into about four groups. First, there's trifluralin. This is strictly preventative.
Only for new pipes.
Only for new installations. It's in these little pellets or fabric strips you put around the joints. The advantage is the chemical stays put. It's not in the flow. Disadvantage is, of course, it's useless if the roots are already in.
Next up, a really common one, but one that professionals need to be wary of, copper products. Copper sulfate, bluestone.
Yes, this is a major compliance point. Copper sulfate works, it kills roots, but copper is a heavy metal. It is highly toxic to those beneficial microbes you need at the wastewater treatment plant.
The ones that clean the sewage.
The ones that do all the work. And on top of that, copper is regulated as a pollutant in the sludge and the effluent from the plant.
And for anyone listening in California, it's a non-starter?
Correct. This is a critical point for them. Copper compounds are not registered for sewer line root control in California. You always have to check your state-specific registrations. The risk of upsetting the plant and getting fined is just not worth it.
Okay. Which brings us to the main event, the workhorses. The combination of metam sodium and diclobenil.
This is the industry standard because they serve two different but necessary functions. Metam sodium is your contact killer. It's fast. It's non-systemic. It just kills what it touches by generating that toxic gas.
And diclobenil.
That's your long-term solution. It's a root growth inhibitor. It basically sticks to the clay and organic material around the pipe joint and creates a lasting chemical barrier to stop that regrowth.
And then there's also sodium hydroxide.
Right. Lye. You often see that paired with another growth inhibitor. The lye isn't really there to kill the roots. It's there for prep work.
It cleans them off.
It liquefies all the grease, soap, and organic gunk that's caked onto the root mass. By removing that layer, it allows the actual herbicide to get in and do its job much more effectively. And just like diclobenil, that other chemical creates the residual barrier to prevent that biological backlash.
Now we get to the core procedure, the foaming application of metam sodium. Let's start with the chemistry, because this is where that danger signal word comes from. How does this stuff work?
So metam sodium, the liquid concentrate, is only stable at a high pH. The moment you dilute it with water, the pH drops, and that triggers a rapid chemical breakdown.
And that breakdown creates the actual killer.
Yes. The result is the formation of a highly volatile and extremely toxic gas called methylisothiocyanate. MITC.
MITC.
Right. And MITC is the fumigant that actually contacts and kills the root tissue.
And it's critical for applicators to get that MITC is way more toxic than the liquid they started with.
Way more. It's an extremely powerful irritant. Inhaling it is the main danger. It can rapidly irritate your respiratory system, lead to severe distress. In bad cases, it causes pulmonary edema.
Fluid in the lungs.
Fluid in the lungs. We're talking severe coughing, sometimes with bloody, frothy sputum. This is why the PPE rules are so absolute.
And that danger word on the label, the highest warning level there is, that's not just about the gas, is it?
No, that's a key point. The danger signal word also applies to the liquid concentrate itself because it is highly corrosive to your skin. And if there's sodium hydroxide in the mix, that's extremely caustic. It can cause irreversible eye damage or severe chemical burns almost instantly.
You have to respect both the gas and the liquid.
Both. Absolutely.
So given how hazardous and volatile this stuff is, why is foaming the approved method? Why not just pour the liquid down the manhole?
Foaming is mandatory because it's the control mechanism. It's how you manage the contact, the duration, and the containment all at once. There are five huge advantages.
Let's hear them.
One, it effectively fills the pipe. Roots live in the air above the water, remember? So the foam has to expand and fill that whole void to get 360-degree contact.
Makes sense.
Two, it gives you contact time. Liquid just washes away. The foam is engineered to collapse slowly, giving you about an hour of contact time for that MITC gas to really penetrate and work.
Okay, what's three?
Vapor containment. This is a massive public safety issue. The dense foam traps the MITC vapor. It stops it from just drifting down the pipe and coming up into other manholes, or, even worse, up through a dry trap into someone's house.
That's terrifying.
It is. Four, it helps penetration. The foam has surfactants in it that break down all that grease on the roots, making sure the chemical actually reaches the target.
And the last one.
Service continuity. Foaming lets you treat the pipes while they're still in service, still carrying flow. You don't have to shut down the system.
And the quality of that foam is everything. What's the target consistency?
You're looking for something that looks like shaving cream. Dense, small, dry bubbles.
And it changes based on the pipe size.
It does. The key metric is the expansion ratio. For smaller pipes, you want a drier foam, maybe a 20-to-1 ratio. 1 gallon of liquid makes 20 gallons of foam. That gives you maximum fill.
And for bigger pipes?
For large interceptors, you might use a slightly wetter foam, maybe 14-to-1. It's better for coating the walls without using a crazy amount of product. It's a fine balance. Too wet, it washes away. Too dry, it doesn't have enough active ingredient.
So that brings us to safety gear. Given the danger word, what is the absolute minimum personal protective equipment, the PPE, you need?
This is where compliance gets real. For body wear, you need outer protective clothing, like coveralls, over a long-sleeved shirt and long pants. And during mixing and loading, a waterproof apron is mandatory for splash protection.
And gloves have to be a specific type.
Gauntlet length, chemical resistant, nitrile, neoprene, something like that. And here's a procedure that people get wrong all the time. Your sleeves have to be worn outside your gloves.
Why is that?
If your gloves are over your sleeves, any spill that runs down your arm has a perfect channel to run right inside your glove, and it traps that corrosive chemical against your skin.
Ouch. And boots.
Same principle. Calf-high waterproof boots, and your pants go outside the boots. You want everything to shed away from your body.
Eye protection has to be a top priority with caustic chemicals.
Goggles are mandated. They give you a full seal against splash and vapor. A face shield is also highly recommended when you're mixing the concentrate.
Okay, last one and maybe the most critical, respiratory protection.
It's tied directly to that MITC gas. At a minimum, you need to have NIOSH-approved cartridge respirators available, and you have to wear them if you can smell that pungent, sulfurous odor.
But that's not enough for every situation.
Absolutely not. If you are entering a confined space, a manhole, a tunnel, a cartridge respirator is not good enough. You are required to use supplied air respirators, SCBA.
A full breathing apparatus.
A full-on breathing apparatus. And this leads to another crucial compliance point a lot of people miss.
What's that?
Facial hair, beards, long sideburns, they prevent a proper seal on a cartridge respirator. So regulations are strict. If you have a beard, you cannot wear that type of respirator because it simply won't protect you from the gas. It's a huge safety enforcement issue.
So the big challenge here is that you're putting this biocide, this killer, into a system that depends on beneficial life to function.
That's the critical nexus. The wastewater treatment plant, the WWTP, Metamsodium will kill anything, including the good microbes the plant needs for secondary treatment to break down sewage.
So coordination with the plant operators is, it's not optional.
It is non-negotiable. You have to communicate with them beforehand. What are you using, when, how much?
And what are they looking for?
Two things. First, that pungent, rotten egg, sulfur-like odor, that tells them MITC is arriving. Second, they're monitoring the health of their microbial population, their bugs, for any signs of an upset.
And they have a good reason to be worried.
Oh, yeah. Plant managers face insane fines up to $25,000 a day for violating their NPDES permit if their process gets knocked out and they have to bypass treatment.
And violating an NPDES permit, for our listeners, that's a federal environmental crime, right?
It is. That permit dictates what the plant can legally discharge into a river or the ocean. If the treatment process is dead, the water they release is polluted. The fines are steep because the environmental damage can be severe.
Which all leads back to the math. The magic number that keeps everyone safe. The 7 ppm threshold.
7 parts per million, that's the line in the sand. Lab tests showed that at 10 parts per million of active ingredient, you start to see harmful effects on the treatment process.
So you build in a safety margin.
You have to. So professional applicators must work to ensure the concentration arriving at the plant never goes above 7 ppm of active ingredient.
That sounds incredibly precise when you're talking about millions of gallons of sewage.
It requires some very specific application math. You have to calculate your maximum application rate based on the actual flow rate of the plant measured in million gallons per day, or MGD.
Can you give us a simple example of how that works?
Sure. Let's say a treatment plant has a low flow of 1 million gallons a day overnight. The applicator has to calculate how many gallons of their product they can introduce over that period so that when it mixes with that 1 million gallons of sewage, the final concentration is below 7 ppm.
So if the flow is higher, you can use more product.
Exactly. Higher flow means more dilution. Lower flow, you have to back off. It's a constant calculation to stay under that threshold and out of trouble.
And that means timing is everything.
It is. You always want to treat pipes with heavy flow at night during the lowest flow periods. It does two things. First, the chemical spends more time in the pipe, so it works better. And second, it minimizes that slug of chemical heading to the plant, which makes hitting your 7 ppm target much easier.
Let's talk about the physical technique, the hose insertion. This sounds like it needs a lot of calibration.
It does. You insert the hose all the way to the end of the section you're treating. Then you start pumping the foam as you pull the hose back at a very precise calibrated speed.
And how do you figure out that speed?
It's a formula. You need to know how many gallons of foam you need per foot of pipe, and you need to know your equipment's output in gallons per minute.
And the math gives you the retrieval rate.
It gives you the retrieval rate in feet per minute. Applicators have charts for their specific gear and pipe sizes. You pull it too fast, you don't treat the pipe properly. You pull it too slow, you waste product, and you risk blowing past your 7 ppm limit downstream.
We have to spend some time on what is clearly the most dangerous part of this job for the public, treating lateral service lines.
The high risk zone, absolutely.
The pipes going directly into people's homes.
Right. They're small, 4 to 6 inches. You often have no idea what the plumbing configuration is, and you have immediate risk factors. Basements, floor drains, dry P traps.
All potential pathways for the gas to get inside.
For toxic foam or vapor to back up right into the building, it is a public health emergency waiting to happen.
So what's the procedure to prevent that?
Physical isolation. You have to use a special air plug or a blocker. You insert it through the building's clean out to physically seal off the interior plumbing from the lateral line you're treating.
And you only pump away from the house?
Only toward the main sewer. And the absolute non-negotiable rule is this. Do not treat laterals from buildings unless you have physical access and you can isolate it. And you must have a spotter inside every single building while you're treating that line.
If that spotter smells anything, the job stops.
Immediately. The operation is shut down.
And that brings us to the emergency plan.
Yeah.
If a spill happens outdoors, or if foam does get inside, what's the control, confine, cleanup protocol?
Every single leak is an emergency. For an outdoor spill, the first step is control. Stop the leak, get your full PPE on. Second is confine. You build a dike around it with sand, kitty litter, soil, whatever you have. The one thing you must not do is hose it down.
Because that just spreads it.
Spreads it right into the storm drain. The third step is cleanup. You shovel all that contaminated material into sealed, labeled containers for proper hazardous waste disposal.
And for that nightmare indoor scenario, foam in a building.
First, evacuate everyone immediately. Then you ventilate, open all the windows, get fans going. For cleanup, again, no hoses. You wear full PPE and you physically remove the foam with a squeegee or a wet vac and you dispose of it down a manhole. Then you wash the area with detergent. It's a very specific mandatory procedure.
So what does this all mean? We have gone on a huge journey here from a simple sewer backup all the way to the hydrotropism of roots.
And through the regulatory labyrinth of FIFRA.
Right. Navigating the extreme toxicity of MITC gas, solving the math to hit that 7 ppm threshold.
It means that what these professionals do is so much more than a maintenance task. It's a critical infrastructure management science.
It's a combination of so many fields.
It's civil engineering, microbiology, highly regulated chemistry, and complex math. And for the businesses that rely on this study guide, it just reinforces that you need precise, compliant, documented work to keep the public safe and avoid just catastrophic hazards.
So the job is done. From a manager's point of view, how do you know if it even worked?
That's the tricky part. It's actually very difficult to tell immediately with a video camera.
Why is that?
Because a live root mass is brown and dirty, and a newly killed root mass is also brown and dirty. It looks exactly the same.
So you can't tell the difference?
Not right away. The decay process, which is driven by the bacteria in the sewage, is slow. It can take months, sometimes even a year or more, for all that dead root tissue to break off and wash away.
So if you can't rely on a camera right after the job, what is the true metric for a successful program?
The most reliable measure is operational and it's long-term. You track the rate of reduction in sewer stoppages and emergency calls over time.
Ah, so it's about the data.
It's all about the data. Success isn't zero roots. That's often impossible. Success is managing the root intrusion so that it stays below the cost and the risk threshold of blockages and overflows.
It's a long-term infrastructure health plan.
Exactly. And, you know, that brings us to our final provocative thought for today.
Okay.
The short-term goal of the chemical treatment is, without a doubt, the swift, aggressive kill of the roots with that MITC gas.
Right. The fumigant.
But the long-term, lasting success of the entire program, it relies completely on the sewer's own environment, on that complex world of decay, organisms, and bacteria that are already in the sewage to slowly and naturally break down all that dead root tissue.
So the chemical is the intervention, but you're actually depending on the biology of the sewer to finish the job for you.
You are. The chemical control is never instantaneous. It is a prolonged partnership with the hidden environment inside the pipe to maintain infrastructure health.
Something to think about the next time you see a thirsty willow tree growing near a sewer line.